Let me be the child in the story, and declare that the emperor is naked, or that America is culturally bankrupt. In any given period of history, a culture is to be judged by its dominant philosophy, by the prevalent trend of its intellectual life as expressed in morality, in politics, in economics, in art. Professional intellectuals are the voice of a culture and are therefore its leaders, its integrators, and its bodyguards. America's intellectual leadership has collapsed. Her virtues, her values, her enormous power are scattered in a silent underground and will remain private, subjective, historically impotent if left without intellectual expression. America is a country without voice or defense, a country sold out and abandoned by her intellectual bodyguards. Bankruptcy is defined as the state of being at the end of one's resources. What are the intellectual values or resources offered to us by the present guardians of our culture? In philosophy, we are taught that man's mind is impotent, that reality is unknowable, that knowledge is an illusion, and reason a superstition. In psychology, we are told that man is a helpless automaton, determined by forces beyond his control, motivated by innate depravity. In literature, we are shown a lineup of murderers, dipsomaniacs, drug addicts, neurotics, and psychotics as representatives of man's soul, and are invited to identify our own among them, with the belligerent assertions that life is a sewer, a foxhole, or a rat race, with the whining injunctions that we must love everything except virtue, and forgive everything except greatness. In politics, we are told that America, the greatest, noblest, freest country on earth, is politically and morally inferior to Soviet Russia, the bloodiest dictatorship in history, and that our wealth should be given away to the savages of Asia and Africa, with apologies for the fact that we have produced it while they haven't. If we look at modern intellectuals, we are confronted with the grotesque spectacle of such characteristics as militant uncertainty, crusading cynicism, dogmatic agnosticism, boastful self-abasement, and self-righteous depravity. In an atmosphere of guilt, of panic, of despair, of boredom, and of all-pervasive evasion. If this is not the state of being at the end of one's resources, there is no further place to go. Everybody seems to agree that civilization is facing a crisis, but nobody cares to define its nature, to discover its cause, and to assume the responsibility of formulating a solution. In times of danger, a morally healthy culture rallies its values, its self-esteem, and its crusading spirit to fight for its moral ideals with full righteous confidence. But this is not what we see today. If we ask our intellectual leaders what are the ideals we should fight for, their answer is such a sticky puddle of stale syrup, of benevolent bromides and apologetic generalities about brother love, global progress, and universal prosperity at America's expense, that a fly would not die for it or in it. One of America's tragic errors is that too many of her best minds believe, as they did in the past, that the solution is to turn anti-intellectual and rely on some Cracker Barrel sort of folksy wisdom. The exact opposite is true. What we need most urgently is to recognize the enormous power and the crucial importance of the intellectual professions. A culture cannot exist without a constant stream of ideas and the alert independent minds who originate them. It cannot exist without a philosophy of life, without those who formulate it and express it. A country without intellectuals is like a body without a head, and that is precisely the position of America today. Our present state of cultural disintegration is not maintained and prolonged by intellectuals as such, but by the fact that we haven't any. The majority of those who posture as intellectuals today are frightened as zombies, posturing in a vacuum of their own making, who admit their abdication from the realm of the intellect by embracing such doctrines as existentialism and Zen Buddhism. After decades of preaching that the hallmark of an intellectual consists of proclaiming the impotence of the intellect, These modern zombies are left aghast before the fact that they have succeeded, that they are impotent to ignite the lights of civilization which they have extinguished, that they are impotent to halt the triumphant advance of the primordial brute whom they have released, that they have no answer to give to those voices out of the Dark Ages who gloat that reason and freedom have had their chance and have failed, and that the future, like the long night of the past, belongs once more to faith and force. If all the manufacturers of railroad engines suddenly went irrational and began to manufacture covered wagons instead, nobody would accept the claim that this is a progressive innovation, or that the iron horse has failed. And many men would step into the industrial vacuum to start manufacturing railroad engines. But when this happens in philosophy, when we are offered Zen Buddhism and its equivalents as the latest word in human thought, nobody, so far, has chosen to step into the intellectual vacuum to carry on the work of man's mind. Thus our great industrial civilization is now expected to run railroads, airlines, intercontinental missiles and H-bomb stockpiles by the guidance of philosophical doctrines created by and for barefoot savages who lived in mud holes, scratched the soil for a handful of grain, and gave thanks to the statues of distorted animals whom they worshipped as superior to man. Historically, the professional intellectual is a very recent phenomenon. He dates only from the Industrial Revolution. There are no professional intellectuals in primitive savage societies. There are only witch doctors. There were no professional intellectuals in the Middle Ages. There were only monks in monasteries. In the post-Renaissance era, prior to the birth of capitalism, the men of the intellect, the philosophers, the teachers, the writers, the early scientists, were men without a profession. That is, without a socially recognized position, without a market, without a means of earning a livelihood. Intellectual pursuits had to depend on the accident of inherited wealth, or on the favor and financial support of some wealthy protector. And wealth was not earned on an open market either. Wealth was acquired by conquest, by force, by political power, or by the favor of those who held political power. Tradesmen were more vulnerably and precariously dependent on favor than the intellectuals. The professional businessman and the professional intellectual came into existence together, as brothers born of the Industrial Revolution. Both are the sons of capitalism, and if they perish, they will perish together. The tragic irony will be that they will have destroyed each other, and the major share of the guilt will belong to the intellectual. With very rare and brief exceptions, pre-capitalist societies had no place for the creative power of man's mind, neither in the creation of ideas nor in the creation of wealth. Reason and its practical expression, free trade, were forbidden as a sin and a crime, or were tolerated usually as ignoble activities, under the control of authorities who could revoke the tolerance at whim. Such societies were ruled by faith and its practical expression, force. There were no makers of knowledge and no makers of wealth. There were only witch doctors and tribal chiefs. These two figures dominate every anti-rational period of history, whether one calls them tribal chief and witch doctor, or absolute monarch and religious leader, or dictator and logical positivist. The tragic joke of human history, I am quoting John Galt in Atlas Shrugged, is that on any of the altars men erected, it was always man whom they immolated and the animal whom they enshrined. It was always the animal's attributes, not man's, that humanity worshipped, the idol of instinct and the idol of force, the mystics and the kings, the mystics who longed for an irresponsible consciousness and ruled by means of the claim that their dark emotions were superior to reason, that knowledge came in blind, causeless fits, blindly to be followed, not doubted, and the kings who ruled by means of claws and muscles, with conquest as their method and looting as their aim, with a club or a gun as sole sanction of their power. The defenders of man's soul were concerned with his feelings, and the defenders of man's body were concerned with his stomach, but both were united against his mind. These two figures, the man of faith and the man of force, are philosophical archetypes, psychological symbols, and historical reality. As philosophical archetypes, they embody two variants of a certain view of man and of existence. As psychological symbols, they represent the basic motivation of a great many men who exist in any era, culture, or society. As historical reality, they are the actual rulers of most of mankind's societies, who rise to power whenever men abandon reason. The essential characteristics of these two remain the same in all ages. Attila, the man who rules by brute force, acts on the range of the moment, is concerned with nothing but the physical reality immediately before him, respects nothing but man's muscles, and regards a fist, a club, or a gun as the only answer to any problem. And the witch doctor, the man who dreads physical reality, dreads the necessity of practical action, and escapes into his emotions, into visions of some mystic realm where his wishes enjoy a supernatural power unlimited by the absolute of nature. Superficially, these two may appear to be opposites, but observe what they have in common. A consciousness held down to the perceptual method of functioning, an awareness that does not choose to extend beyond the automatic, the immediate, the given, the involuntary, which means an animal's epistemology or as near to it as a human consciousness can come. Man's consciousness shares with animals the first two stages of its development, sensations and perceptions, but it is the third state, conceptions, that makes him man. Sensations are integrated into perceptions automatically by the brain of a man or of an animal. But to integrate perceptions into conceptions, by a process of abstraction, is a feat that man alone has the power to perform, and he has to perform it by choice. The process of abstraction and of concept formation is a process of reason, of thought. It is not automatic, nor instinctive, nor involuntary, nor infallible. Man has to initiate it, to sustain it, and to bear responsibility for its results. The preconceptual level of consciousness is non-volitional. Volition begins with the first syllogism. Man has the choice to think or to evade, to maintain a state of full awareness, or to drift from moment to moment in a semi-conscious daze at the mercy of whatever associational whims the unfocused mechanism of his consciousness produces. But the living organisms that possess the faculty of consciousness need to exercise it in order to survive. An animal's consciousness functions automatically. An animal perceives what it is able to perceive and survives accordingly, no further than the perceptual level permits, and no better. Man cannot survive on the perceptual level of his consciousness. His senses do not provide him with an automatic guidance. They do not give him the knowledge he needs, only the material of knowledge, which his mind has to integrate. Man is the only living species who has to perceive reality, which means to be conscious, by choice. But he shares with other species the penalty of unconsciousness, destruction. For an animal, the question of survival is primarily physical. For man, primarily epistemological. Man's unique reward, however, is that while animals survive by adjusting themselves to their background, man survives by adjusting his background to himself. If a drought strikes them, animals perish. Man builds irrigation canals. If a flood strikes them, animals perish. Man builds dams. If a carnivorous pack attacks them, animals perish. Man writes the Constitution of the United States. But one does not obtain food, safety, or freedom by instinct. It is against this faculty, the faculty of reason, that Attila and the witch doctor rebel. The key to both their souls is their longing for the effortless, irresponsible, automatic consciousness of an animal. Both dread the necessity, the risk, and the responsibility of rational cognition. Both dread the fact that nature, to be commanded, must be obeyed. Both seek to exist not by conquering nature, but by adjusting to the given, the immediate, the known. There is only one means of survival for those who do not choose to conquer nature, to conquer those who do. The physical conquest of men is Attila's method of survival. He regards men as others regard fruit trees or farm animals, as objects in nature, his for the seizing. But while a good farmer knows at least that fruit trees and animals have a specific nature and require a specific kind of handling, the perceptual mentality of Attila does not extend to so abstract a level. Men to him are a natural phenomenon and an irreducible primary, as all natural phenomena are irreducible primaries to an animal. Attila feels no need to understand, to explain, nor even to wonder how men manage to produce the things he covets. Somehow is a fully satisfactory answer inside his skull, which refuses to consider such questions as how and why, or such concepts as identity and causality. All he needs, his urges tell him, is bigger muscles, bigger clubs, or a bigger gang than theirs, in order to seize their bodies and their products, after which their bodies will obey his commands and will provide him, somehow, with the satisfaction of any whim. He approaches men as a beast of prey, and the consequences of his actions, or the possibility of exhausting his victims, never enters his consciousness, which does not choose to extend beyond the given moment. His view of the universe does not include the power of production. The power of destruction, of brute force, is to him metaphysically omnipotent. An Attila never thinks of creating, only of taking over. Whether he conquers a neighboring tribe or overruns a continent, material looting is his only goal, and it ends with the act of seizure. He has no other purpose, no plan, no system to impose on the conquered, no values. His pleasures are closer to the level of sensations than of perceptions. Food, drink, palatial shelter, rich clothing, indiscriminate sex, contests of physical prowess, gambling. All those activities which do not demand or involve the use of the conceptual level of consciousness. He does not originate his pleasures. He desires and pursues whatever those around him seem to find desirable. Even in the realm of desires he does not create, he merely takes over. But a human being cannot live his life moment by moment. A human consciousness preserves a certain continuity and demands a certain degree of integration, whether a man seeks it or not. A human being needs a frame of reference, a comprehensive view of existence, no matter how rudimentary. And since his consciousness is volitional, a sense of being right, a moral justification of his actions, which means a philosophical code of values, who then provides Attila with values? The witch doctor. If Attila's method of survival is the conquest of those who conquer nature, the witch doctor's method of survival is safer, he believes, and spares him the risks of physical conflict. His method is the conquest of those who conquer nature. It is not men's bodies that he seeks to rule, but men's souls. To Attila, as to an animal, the phenomena of nature are an irreducible primary. To the witch doctor, as to an animal, the irreducible primary is the automatic phenomena of his own consciousness. An animal has no critical faculty. He has no control over the function of his brain, and no power to question its content. To an animal, whatever strikes his awareness is an absolute that corresponds to reality. Or rather, it is a distinction he is incapable of making. Reality, to him, is whatever he senses or feels. And this is the witch doctor's epistemological ideal, the mode of consciousness he strives to induce in himself. To the witch doctor, emotions are tools of cognition, and wishes take precedence over facts. He seeks to escape the risks of a quest for knowledge by obliterating the distinction between consciousness and reality, between the perceiver and the perceived, hoping that an automatic certainty and an infallible knowledge of the universe will be granted to him by the blind, unfocused stare of his eyes turned inward, contemplating the sensations, the feelings, the urgings, the muggy associational twistings projected by the rudderless mechanism of his undirected consciousness. Whatever his mechanism produces is an absolute not to be questioned, and whenever it clashes with reality, it is reality that he ignores. Since the clash is constant, the witch doctor's solution is to believe that what he perceives is another, higher reality, where his wishes are omnipotent, where contradictions are possible, and A is non-A, where his assertions, which are false on earth, become true and acquire the status of a superior truth, which he perceives by means of a special faculty denied to other inferior beings. The only validation of his consciousness he can obtain on earth is the belief and the obedience of others when they accept the truth as superior to their own perception of reality. While Attila extorts their obedience by means of a club, the witch doctor obtains it by means of a much more powerful weapon. He preempts the field of morality. There is no way to turn morality into a weapon of enslavement except by divorcing it from man's reason and from the goals of his own existence. There is no way to degrade man's life on earth except by the lethal opposition of the moral and the practical. Morality is a code of values to guide man's choices and actions. When it is set to oppose his own life and mind, it makes him turn against himself and blindly act as the tool of his own destruction. There is no way to make a human being accept the role of a sacrificial animal except by destroying his self-esteem. There is no way to destroy his self-esteem except by making him reject his own consciousness. There is no way to make him reject his own consciousness except by convincing him of its impotence. The damnation of this earth as a realm where nothing is possible to man but pain, disaster, and defeat, a realm inferior to another higher reality. The damnation of all values, enjoyment, achievement, and success on earth as a proof of depravity. The damnation of man's mind as a source of pride, and the damnation of reason as a limited, deceptive, unreliable, impotent faculty, incapable of perceiving the real reality and the true truth. The split of man in two, setting his consciousness, his soul, against his body, and his moral values against his own interest. The damnation of man's nature, body, and self as evil. The commandment of self-sacrifice, renunciation, suffering, obedience, humility, and faith as the good. The damnation of life and the worship of death with the promise of rewards beyond the grave. These are the necessary tenets of the witch doctor's view of existence, as they have been in every variant of witch doctor philosophy throughout the course of mankind's history. The secret of the witch doctor's power lies in the fact that man needs an integrated view of life, a philosophy, whether he is aware of his need or not. And whenever, through ignorance, cowardice, or mental sloth, men choose not to be aware of it, their chronic sense of guilt, uncertainty, and terror makes them feel that the witch doctor's philosophy is true. The first to feel it is Attila. The man who lives by brute force, at the whim and mercy of the moment, lives on a narrow island suspended in a fog of the unknown, where invisible threats and unpredictable disasters can descend upon him any morning. He is willing to surrender his consciousness to the man who offers him protection against those intangible questions which he does not wish to consider, yet dreads. Attila's fear of reality is as great as the witch doctor's. Both hold their consciousness on a subhuman level and method of functioning. Attila's brain is a jumble of concretes unintegrated by abstractions. The witch doctor's brain is a miasma of floating abstractions unrelated to concretes. Both are guided and motivated, ultimately, not by thoughts, but by feelings and whims. Both cling to their whims as to their only certainty. Both feel secretly inadequate to the task of dealing with existence. Thus they come to need each other. Attila feels that the witch doctor can give him what he lacks, a long-range view, an insurance against the dark unknown of tomorrow, or next week, or next year, a code of moral values to sanction his actions and to disarm his victims. The witch doctor feels that Attila can give him the material means of survival, can protect him from physical reality, can spare him the necessity of practical action, and can enforce his mystic edicts on any recalcitrant who may choose to challenge his authority. Both of them are incomplete parts of a human being who seek completion in each other. The man of muscle and the man of feelings, seeking to exist without mind. Since no man can fully escape the conceptual level of consciousness, it is not the case that Attila and the witch doctor cannot or do not think. They can and do. But thinking to them is not a means of perceiving reality. It is a means of justifying their escape from the necessity of rational perception. Reason to them is a means of defeating their victims, a menial servant charged with the task of rationalizing the metaphysical validity and power of their whims. Just as a bank robber will spend years of planning, ingenuity, and effort in order to prove to himself that he can exist without effort, so both Attila and the witch doctor will go to any length of cunning, calculation, and thought in order to demonstrate the impotence of thought and preserve the image of a pliable universe where miracles are possible and whims are efficacious. The power of ideas has no reality for either of them, and neither cares to learn that the proof of that power lies in his own chronic sense of guilt and terror. Thus Attila and the witch doctor form an alliance and divide their respective domains. Attila rules the realm of men's physical existence. The witch doctor rules the realm of men's consciousness. Attila herds men into armies. The witch doctor sets the army's goals. Attila conquers empires. The witch doctor writes their laws. Attila loots and plunders. The witch doctor exhorts the victims to surpass their selfish concern with material property. Attila slaughters. The witch doctor proclaims to the survivors that scourges are a retribution for their sins. Attila rules by means of fear, by keeping men under a constant threat of destruction. The witch doctor rules by means of guilt, by keeping men convinced of their innate depravity, impotence, and insignificance. Attila turns men's life on earth into a living hell. The witch doctor tells them that it could not be otherwise. But the alliance of the two rulers is precarious. It is based on mutual fear and mutual contempt. Attila is an extrovert, resentful of any concern with consciousness. The witch doctor is an introvert, resentful of any concern with physical existence. Attila professes scorn for values, ideals, principles, theories, abstractions. The witch doctor professes scorn for material property, for wealth, for man's body, for this earth. Attila considers the witch doctor impractical. The witch doctor considers Attila immoral. But secretly, each of them believes that the other possesses a mysterious faculty he lacks. That the other is the true master of reality, the true exponent of the power to deal with existence. In terms not of thought but of chronic anxiety, it is the witch doctor who believes that brute force rules the world, and it is Attila who believes in the supernatural. His name for it is fate or luck. Against whom is this alliance formed? Against those men whose existence and character both Attila and the witch doctor refuse to admit into their view of the universe. The men who produce. In any age or society, there are men who think and work, who discover how to deal with existence, how to produce the intellectual and the material values it requires. These are the men whose effort is the only means of survival for the parasites of all varieties. The Attilas, the witch doctors, and the human ballast. The ballast consists of those who go through life in a state of unfocused stupor, merely repeating the words and the motions they learned from others. But the men from whom they learn, the men who are first to discover any scrap of new knowledge, are the men who deal with reality, with the task of conquering nature, and who to that extent assume the responsibility of cognition, of exercising their rational faculty. A producer is any man who works and knows what he is doing. He may function on a fully human conceptual level of awareness only some part of his time, but to that extent he is the Atlas who supports the existence of mankind. He may spend the rest of his time in an unthinking daze like the others, and to that extent he is the exploited, drained, tortured, self-destroying victim of their schemes. Men's epistemology, or more precisely their psycho-epistemology, their method of awareness, is the most fundamental standard by which they can be classified. Few men are consistent in that respect. Most men keep switching from one level of awareness to another according to the circumstances of the issues involved, ranging from moments of full rationality to an almost somnambulistic stupor. But the battle of human history is fought and determined by those who are predominantly consistent, those who, for good or evil, are committed to and motivated by their chosen psycho-epistemology and its corollary view of existence, with echoes responding to them in support or opposition in the switching, flickering souls of the others. A man's method of using his consciousness determines his method of survival. The three contestants are Attila, the witch doctor, and the producer, or the man of force, the man of feelings, the man of reason, or the brute, the mystic, the thinker. The rest of mankind calls it expedient to be tossed by the current of events from one of those roles to another, not choosing to identify the fact that those three are the source which determines the current's direction. The producers so far have been the forgotten men of history. With the exception of a few brief periods, the producers have not been the leaders or the term-setters of men's societies, although the degree of their influence and freedom was the degree of a society's welfare and progress. Most societies have been ruled by Attila and the witch doctor. The cause is not some innate tendency to evil in human nature, but the fact that reason is a volitional faculty, which man has to choose to discover, employ, and preserve. Irrationality is a state of default, the state of an unachieved human stature. When men do not choose to reach the conceptual level, their consciousness has no recourse but to its automatic, perceptual, semi-animal functions. If a missing link between the human and the animal species is to be found, Attila and the witch doctor are that missing link, the profiteers on men's default. The sound of the first human step in recorded history, the prelude to the entrance of the producer on the historical scene, was the birth of philosophy in ancient Greece. All earlier cultures had been ruled not by reason, but by mysticism. The task of philosophy, the formulation of an integrated view of man, of existence, of the universe, was the monopoly of various religions that enforced their views by the authority of a claim to supernatural knowledge, and dictated the rules that controlled men's lives. Philosophy was born in a period when Attila was impotent to assist the witch doctor, when a comparative degree of political freedom undercut the power of mysticism, and for the first time, man was free to face an unobstructed universe, free to declare that his mind was competent to deal with all the problems of his existence, and that reason was his only means of knowledge. Even though the influence of the witch doctor's views permeated the works of the early philosophers, reason, for the first time, was identified and acknowledged as man's ruling faculty, a recognition it had never been granted before. Plato's system was a monument to the witch doctor's metaphysics, with its two realities, with the physical world as a semi-illusory, imperfect, inferior realm subordinated to a realm of abstractions, which means, in fact, though not in Plato's statement, subordinated to man's consciousness. With reason in the position of an inferior but necessary servant that paves the way for the ultimate burst of mystic revelation, which discloses a superior truth. But Aristotle's philosophy was the intellect's declaration of independence. Aristotle, the father of logic, should be given the title of the world's first intellectual, in the purest and noblest sense of that word. No matter what remnants of Platonism did exist in Aristotle's system, his incomparable achievement lay in the fact that he defined the basic principles of a rational view of existence and of man's consciousness, that there is only one reality, the one which man perceives, that it exists as an objective absolute, which means independently of the consciousness, the wishes, or the feelings of any perceiver, that the task of man's consciousness is to perceive, not to create, reality, that abstractions are man's method of integrating his sensory material, that man's mind is his only tool of knowledge, that A is A. If we consider the fact that to this day, everything that makes us civilized beings, every rational value that we possess, including the birth of science, the Industrial Revolution, the creation of the United States, even the structure of our language, is the result of Aristotle's influence, of the degree to which, explicitly or implicitly, men accepted his epistemological principles. We would have to say, never have so many owed so much to one man. Just as the witch doctor is impotent without Attila, so Attila is impotent without the witch doctor. Neither can make his power last without the other. Politically, the centuries of the Greco-Roman civilization were still dominated by Attila, by the rule of local tyrants or tribal aristocracies. But it was a tame, uncertain, subdued Attila who had to contend with the influence of philosophy, not of faith, in men's minds. The best aspects of Western civilization still owe their roots to the intellectual achievements of that era. Attila regained his power with the rise of statism in the Roman Empire. What followed was the fall of Rome as a drained hulk, bankrupt in spirit and body, unable to muster any power of resistance to the invasion of barbarian hordes. Then the looting and devastation of Europe by the literal Attila, and the centuries of brute violence, of bloody tribal warfare, of unrecorded chaos known as the Dark Ages. The witch doctors were re-emerging, with a new version of mysticism in answer to the pleas for help of the various local Attilas, who were bowing to them voluntarily in speedy conversions in exchange for the guidance of some form of basic principles to help them stabilize their power. The Middle Ages was a period ruled by the witch doctor, in a firm, if mutually jealous, alliance with Attila. The witch doctors controlled every aspect of human life and thought, while the feudal Attilas looted one another's domains, collected material tributes from serfs, who worked, lived, and starved in subhuman conditions, and maintained the witch doctors' monopoly on spiritual law and order by the power to burn heretics at the stake. Philosophy in that era existed as a handmaiden of theology, and the dominant influence was appropriately Plato's, in the form of Plotinus and Augustine. Aristotle's works were lost to the scholars of Europe for centuries. The prelude to the Renaissance was the return of Aristotle via Thomas Aquinas. The Renaissance, the rebirth of man's mind, blasted the rule of the witch doctor sky high, setting the earth free of his power. The liberation was not total, nor was it immediate. The convulsions lasted for centuries, but the cultural influence of mysticism, of avowed mysticism, was broken. Men could no longer be told to reject their mind as an impotent tool, when the proof of its potency was so magnificently evident that the lowest perceptual level mentality was not able fully to evade it. Men were seeing the achievements of science. The Renaissance did not dethrone Attila at once. He clung to his fading power a while longer, building his absolute monarchies on the remnants of his crumbling feudal state. But once again, as in the Greco-Roman era, Attila was ineffectual when left on his own. He was mentally helpless and scared, unable to cope with the tide of liberation sweeping the world. He ran blindly amok in the practice of his only skill and purpose, that of material extortion, bringing nations to ragged poverty by his constant wars and levies, taxing away the last of his subjects' possessions. But when it came to intellectual issues, he kept appeasing the advocates of freedom. He assumed the role of their pupil, protector, and patron of the arts, lapsing occasionally into frantic bursts of censorship and persecution, then returning to the role of enlightened monarch. Attila, like any bully and like many animals, feels confident only when he smells fear in his opponents. And it is not fear that thinkers project when they fight for the freedom of the mind. The divine right of kings was not much of a weapon against men who were discovering the rights of man. The Industrial Revolution completed the task of the Renaissance. It blasted Attila off his throne. For the first time in history, men gained control over physical nature and threw off the control of men over men. That is, men discovered science and political freedom. The first society in history whose leaders were neither Attilas nor witch doctors. A society led, dominated, and created by the producers was the United States of America. The moral code implicit in its political principles was not the witch doctor's code of self-sacrifice. The political principles embodied in its constitution were not Attila's blank check on brute force, but men's protection against any future Attila's ambition. The Founding Fathers were neither passive, death-worshipping mystics nor mindless, power-seeking looters. As a political group, they were a phenomenon unprecedented in history. They were thinkers who were also men of action. They had rejected the soul-body dichotomy with its two corollaries, the impotence of man's mind and the damnation of this earth. They had rejected the doctrine of suffering as man's metaphysical fate. They proclaimed man's right to the pursuit of happiness and were determined to establish on earth the conditions required for man's proper existence by the unaided power of their intellect. A society based on and geared to the conceptual level of man's consciousness, a society dominated by a philosophy of reason, has no place for the rule of fear and guilt. Reason requires freedom, self-confidence, and self-esteem. It requires the right to think and to act on the guidance of one's thinking, the right to live by one's own independent judgment. Intellectual freedom cannot exist without political freedom. Political freedom cannot exist without economic freedom. A free mind and a free market are corollaries. The unprecedented social system whose fundamentals were established by the Founding Fathers, the system which set the terms, the example and the pattern for the 19th century spreading to all the countries of the civilized world, was capitalism. To be exact, it was not a full, perfect, totally unregulated laissez-faire capitalism. Various degrees of government interference and control still remained, even in America, as deadly cracks in the system's foundations. But during the 19th century, the world came close to economic freedom for the first and only time in history. The degree of any given country's economic freedom was the exact degree of its progress. America, the freest, achieved the most. Capitalism wiped out slavery in matter and in spirit. It replaced Attila and the witch doctor, the looter of wealth and the purveyor of revelations, with two new types of man, the producer of wealth and the purveyor of knowledge, the businessman and the intellectual. Capitalism demands the best of every man, his rationality, and rewards him accordingly. It leaves every man free to choose the work he likes, to specialize in it, to trade his product for the products of others, and to go as far on the road of achievement as his ability and ambition will carry him. His success depends on the objective value of his work and on the rationality of those who recognize that value. When men are free to trade, with reason and reality as their only arbiter, when no man may use physical force to extort the consent of another, it is the best product and the best judgment that win in every field of human endeavor, and raise the standard of living and of thought ever higher for all those who take part in mankind's productive activity. In this complex pattern of human cooperation, two key figures act as the twin motors of progress, the integrators of the entire system, the transmission belts that carry the achievements of the best minds to every level of society, the intellectual and the businessman. The professional intellectual is the field agent of the army whose commander-in-chief is the philosopher. The intellectual carries the application of philosophical principles to every field of human endeavor. He sets a society's course by transmitting ideas from the ivory tower of the philosopher to the university professor, to the writer, to the artist, to the newspaper man, to the politician, to the movie maker, to the nightclub singer, to the man in the street. The intellectual's specific professions are in the field of the sciences that study man, the so-called humanities. But for that very reason, his influence extends to all other professions. Those who deal with the sciences studying nature have to rely on the intellectual for philosophical guidance and information, for moral values, for social theories, for political premises, for psychological tenets, and above all, for the principles of epistemology, that crucial branch of philosophy which studies man's means of knowledge and makes all other sciences possible. The intellectual is the eyes, ears, and voice of a free society. It is his job to observe the events of the world, to evaluate their meaning, and to inform the men in all the other fields. A free society has to be an informed society. In the stagnation of feudalism, with castes and guilds of serfs repeating the same motions generation after generation, the services of traveling minstrels chanting the same old legends were sufficient. But in the racing torrent of progress, which is capitalism, where the free choices of individual men determine their own lives and the course of the entire economy, where opportunities are unlimited, where discoveries are constant, where the achievements of every profession affect all the others, men need a knowledge wider than their particular specialties. They need those who can point the way to the better mousetrap, or the better cyclotron, or the better symphony, or the better view of existence. The more specialized and diversified a society, the greater its need for the integrating power of knowledge. But the acquisition of knowledge on so wide a scale is a full-time profession. A free society has to count on the honor of its intellectuals. It has to expect them to be as efficient, reliable, precise, and objective as the printing presses and the television sets that carry their voices. The professional businessman is the field agent of the army whose lieutenant commander-in-chief is the scientist. The businessman carries scientific discoveries from the laboratory of the inventor to industrial plants and transforms them into material products that fill men's physical needs and expand the comfort of men's existence. By creating a mass market, he makes these products available to every income level of society. By using machines, he increases the productivity of human labor, thus raising labor's economic rewards. By organizing human effort into productive enterprises, he creates employment for men of countless professions. He is the great liberator, who in the short span of a century and a half has released men from bondage to their physical needs, has released them from the terrible drudgery of an 18-hour workday of manual labor for their barest subsistence, has released them from famines, from pestilences, from the stagnant hopelessness and terror in which most of mankind had lived in all the pre-capitalist centuries, and in which most of it still lives in non-capitalist countries. It is on this fundamental division of labor and of responsibility that the intellectual has defaulted. His twin brother, the businessman, has done a superlative job and has brought men to an unprecedented material prosperity. But the intellectual has sold him out, has betrayed their common source, has failed in his own job, and has brought men to spiritual bankruptcy. The businessman has raised men's standard of living, but the intellectual has dropped men's standard of thought to the level of an impotent savage. It has often been noted that mankind has achieved an enormous material progress, but has remained on the level of the primitive brute in spirit. The solution usually offered is to abandon material progress. The cause of the discrepancy is ignored or evaded. The cause is to be found at that crossroads of the post-Renaissance period when men's physical existence and his philosophy broke apart and went in different directions. Just as a man's actions are preceded and determined by some form of idea in his mind, so a society's existential conditions are preceded and determined by the ascendancy of a certain philosophy among those whose job is to deal with ideas. The events of any given period of history are the result of the thinking of the preceding period. The 19th century, with its political freedom, science, industry, business, trade, all the necessary conditions of material progress, was the result and the last achievement of the intellectual power released by the Renaissance. The men engaged in those activities were still riding on the remnants of an Aristotelian influence in philosophy, particularly on an Aristotelian epistemology, more implicitly than explicitly, but they were like men living on the energy of the light rays of a distant star, who did not know, it was not their primary task to know, that that star had been extinguished. It had been extinguished by those whose primary task was to sustain it. From the start of the post-Renaissance period, philosophy, released from its bondage as handmaiden of theology, went seeking a new form of servitude, like a frightened slave, broken in spirit, who recoils from the responsibility of freedom. Descartes set the direction of the retreat by bringing the witch doctor back into philosophy. While promising a philosophical system as rational, demonstrable, and scientific as mathematics, Descartes began with the basic epistemological premise of every witch doctor, a premise he shared explicitly with Augustine. The prior certainty of consciousness, the belief that the existence of an external world is not self-evident, but must be proved by deduction from the contents of one's consciousness, which means the concept of consciousness as some faculty other than the faculty of perception, which means the indiscriminate contents of one's consciousness as the irreducible primary and absolute to which reality has to conform. What followed was the grotesquely tragic spectacle of philosophers struggling to prove the existence of an external world by staring with the witch doctor's blind inward stare at the random twists of their conceptions, then of perceptions, then of sensations. When the medieval witch doctor had merely ordered men to doubt the validity of their mind, the philosopher's rebellion against him consisted of proclaiming that they doubted whether man was conscious at all, and whether anything existed for him to be conscious of. It is at this point that Attila entered the philosophical scene. Attila, the type of man who longs to live on the perceptual level of consciousness, without the interference of any concepts, to act on the whim and range of the moment, without the hampering restriction of principles or theories, without the necessity of integrating one experience with another or one moment with the next, saw his chance to escape from his subservience to the witch doctor, which he had always resented, to muscle in on the racket, one would have to say, and to obtain from science the sanction of his actions and of his psychoepistemology. Attila, who hated and feared intellectual issues, saw his chance to take over the intellect and found his voice. When Hume declared that he saw objects moving about, but never saw such a thing as causality, it was the voice of Attila that men were hearing. It was Attila's soul that spoke when Hume declared that he experienced a flow of fleeting states inside his skull, such as sensations, feelings, or memories, but had never caught the experience of such a thing as consciousness or self. When Hume declared that the apparent existence of an object did not guarantee that it would not vanish spontaneously next moment, and the sunrise of today did not prove that the sun would rise tomorrow. When he declared that philosophical speculation was a game, like chess or hunting, of no significance whatever to the practical course of human existence, since reason proved that existence was unintelligible, and only the ignorant maintained the illusion of knowledge. All of this accompanied by vehement opposition to the mysticism of the witch doctor, and by protestations of loyalty to reason and science. What men were hearing was the manifesto of a philosophical movement that can be designated only as Attilaism. If it were possible for an animal to describe the content of his consciousness, the result would be a transcript of Hume's philosophy. Hume's conclusions would be the conclusions of a consciousness limited to the perceptual level of awareness, passively reacting to the experience of immediate concretes, with no capacity to form abstractions, to integrate perceptions into concepts, waiting in vain for the appearance of an object labeled causality, except that such a consciousness would not be able to draw conclusions. To negate man's mind, it is the conceptual level of his consciousness that has to be invalidated. Under all the tortuous complexities, contradictions, equivocations, rationalizations of the post-Renaissance philosophy, the one consistent line, the fundamental that explains the rest, is a concerted attack on man's conceptual faculty. Most philosophers did not intend to invalidate conceptual knowledge, but its defenders did more to destroy it than did its enemies. They were unable to offer a solution to the problem of universals, that is, to define the nature and source of abstractions, to determine the relationship of concepts to perceptual data, and to prove the validity of scientific induction. Ignoring the lead of Aristotle, who had not left them a full answer to the problem, but had shown the direction and the method by which the answer could be found, the philosophers were unable to refute the witch doctor's claim that their concepts were as arbitrary as his whims, and that their scientific knowledge had no greater metaphysical validity than his revelations. The philosophers chose to solve the problem by conceding the witch doctor's claim, and by surrendering to him the conceptual level of man's consciousness, a victory no witch doctor could have hoped to achieve on his own. The form of that absurd concession was the philosopher's ultimate division into two camps: those who claimed that man obtains his knowledge of the world by deducing it exclusively from concepts, which come from inside his head and are not derived from the perception of physical facts, the rationalists, and those who claimed that man obtains his knowledge from experience, which was held to mean by direct perception of immediate facts with no recourse to concepts, the empiricists. To put it more simply, those who joined the witch doctor by abandoning reality, and those who clung to reality by abandoning their mind. Thus, reason was pushed off the philosophical scene by default, by implication, by evasion. What had started as a serious problem between two camps of serious thinkers soon degenerated to the level where nothing was left on the field of philosophy but a battle between witch doctors and Attilaists. The man who formalized this state and closed the door of philosophy to reason was Immanuel Kant. Kant gave metaphysical expression to the psycho-epistemology of Attila and the witch doctor, and to their primordial existential relationship, shutting out of his universe the existence and the psycho-epistemology of the producer. He surrendered philosophy to Attila, and ensured its future delivery back into the power of the witch doctor. He turned the world over to Attila, but reserved to the witch doctor the realm of morality. Kant's expressly stated purpose was to save the morality of self-abnegation and self-sacrifice. He knew that it could not survive without a mystic base, and what it had to be saved from was reason. Attila's share of Kant's universe includes this earth, physical reality, man's senses, perceptions, reason, and science, all of it labeled the phenomenal world. The witch doctor's share is another, higher reality labeled the noumenal world, and a special manifestation labeled the categorical imperative, which dictates to man the rules of morality and which makes itself known by means of a feeling, as a special sense of duty. The phenomenal world, said Kant, is not real. Reality, as perceived by man's mind, is a distortion. The distorting mechanism is man's conceptual faculty. Man's basic concepts, such as time, space, existence, are not derived from experience or reality, but come from an automatic system of filters in his consciousness, labeled categories and forms of perception, which impose their own design on his perception of the external world and make him incapable of perceiving it in any manner other than the one in which he does perceive it. This proves, said Kant, that man's concepts are only a delusion, but a collective delusion, which no one has the power to escape. Thus reason and science are limited, said Kant. They are valid only so long as they deal with this world, with a permanent, predetermined collective delusion. And thus the criterion of reason's validity was switched from the objective to the collective. But they are impotent to deal with the fundamental metaphysical issues of existence, which belong to the noumenal world. The noumenal world is unknowable. It is the world of real reality, superior truth, and things in themselves, or things as they are, which means things as they are not perceived by man. Even apart from the fact that Kant's theory of the categories as the source of man's concepts was a preposterous invention, his argument amounted to a negation, not only of man's consciousness, but of any consciousness, of consciousness as such. His argument in essence ran as follows: man is limited to a consciousness of a specific nature, which perceives by specific means and no others. Therefore, his consciousness is not valid. Man is blind because he has eyes, deaf because he has ears, deluded because he has a mind, and the things he perceives do not exist because he perceives them. As to Kant's version of morality, it was appropriate to the kind of zombies that would inhabit that kind of universe. It consisted of total abject selflessness. An action is moral, said Kant, only if one has no desire to perform it, but performs it out of a sense of duty, and derives no benefit from it of any sort, neither material nor spiritual. A benefit destroys the moral value of an action. Thus, if one has no desire to be evil, one cannot be good. If one has, one can. Those who accept any part of Kant's philosophy, metaphysical, epistemological, or moral, deserve it. If one finds the present state of the world unintelligible and inexplicable, one can begin to understand it by realizing that the dominant intellectual influence today is still Kant's, and that all the leading modern schools of philosophy are derived from a Kantian base. The popular slang expression head shrinker, applied to psychologists, is much more literally applicable to Kant. Observe the sharp drop in the intellectual stature of the post-Kantian philosophers, and the progressively thickening veil of grayness, superficiality, casuistry that descends on the history of philosophy thereafter, like a fog enveloping a sluggish river that runs thinner and thinner and finally vanishes in the swamps of the 20th century. The major line of philosophers rejected Kant's noumenal world quite speedily, but they accepted his phenomenal world and carried it to its logical consequences. The view of reality as mere appearance, the view of man's conceptual faculty as a mechanism for producing arbitrary constructs not derived from experience or facts, the view of rational certainty as impossible, of science as unprovable, of man's mind as impotent, and above all, the equation of morality with selflessness. They rejected the root or cause of Kant's system, but accepted all of its deadly effects. They accepted it as some monstrous spider hanging in mid-air, in a web of unintelligible, almost unreadable verbiage. And today, few people know that that spider is not supported by a single thread of proof. Such was the intellectual equipment with which philosophers approached the task of observing the unprecedented historical events of the 19th century, and the responsibility of providing guidance for the new free society of capitalism. While scientists were performing astounding feats of disciplined reason, breaking down the barriers of the unknowable in every field of knowledge, charting the course of light rays in space, or the course of blood in the capillaries of man's body, what philosophy was offering them as interpretation of and guidance for their achievements was the plain witch doctrine of Hegel, who proclaimed that matter does not exist at all, that everything is idea, not somebody's idea, just idea, and that this idea operates by the dialectical process of a new superlogic. This book is continued on Disc 2.